Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm. That's over at Twitter and, of course, RedState.com. You can find him in the VIP section and sometimes out in the clear section as well. He does a lot of great VIP columns. We're going to talk about one in particular today. Before we get to that, though, I was reading something today, and I think you'll be, I think it is going to end up dovetailing into what your column was. You actually got two good columns over there, but you really got tons of good columns, but the two most recent ones are really good. The Wall Street Journal reported today that, do you remember the great stock market crash of 2025? The one that was going to have utter devastation.
Yeah. I wonder what that journalism happened to that in.
Well, as it turns out, the S&P 500 is up 8% over the last 3 months. And then I did the calculations myself, and this just went up as we're starting to record this. The NASDAQ is up like 15% since the day of Liberation Day. And it's up about, I think, 6% overall through the year. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average isn't quite where it was at in February, but it's about 5% higher than it was on Liberation Day. And then I went and took a look at the inflation, because I remember the great trinity of disasters was about to visit itself upon us. Right?
Well, tell us, Ed.
The great trinity of disasters. You're going to have the stock market crash, runaway inflation, and massive shortages in the stores. There, you know, the empty shelves and all this kind of stuff. And I went and took a look at the inflation numbers. And, you know, they've been flat for the last 3 months and better than any of the months of the last maybe 4 or 5 months of the Biden administration, where it was starting to tick up again. And I mean, I'm not going to say that it can't happen, but what I'm going to say is there were a whole bunch of people that were screaming that the sky was falling, and all of them seemed to be employees of America's, you know, news industry, or I've decided I'm dispensing with the term newsroom, Andrew, and I have a new term for you. I'm going to run it by you.
Okay.
It's the narrative laboratory. These are narrative laboratories. Does that work for you?
One. Yeah, that works for me. Sure. The narrative laboratory. And we'll have to come up with, lengthen it a bit and give it an acronym. That narrative laboratory.
NAL. Official narrative laboratory of the year only. I don't know. That's lame. Never mind. I skipped that one. Never mind.
Yeah. Oh boy. TDS. Well, anyway, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? Now, to be fair, for a nanosecond, bad news is always more exciting than good news. I mean, even in neighborhoods, people gossip about the arguing couple down at the end of the street. They don't argue about the family with four kids making their bill payments on time. But it's so indicative of the current media. It's more than a narrative. It's a mindset that anything possibly negative will be played up and exaggerated, just as you mentioned on the economy and inflation and et cetera. Just as last week they immediately jumped on an initial low confidence intelligence report,
right,
about the damage in the bombing site. You know, and I mentioned in the column today, and I know we're going to get to it, but I mentioned in the column today that journalism that I aspired to and worked in for a long, long time, many decades, it had a set of standards that were self-imposed and sometimes violated by individuals who were dumb or evil. But by and large, when a public official said something, your first thought was not, how can I prove him wrong to make him look bad because I don't like his politics? The first thought was, why is he telling me this in an honestly, not cynical, but skeptical way? And that led you to the questions that you would ask yourself or ask him or her to produce a balanced report. You don't get that anymore. Even the gods agree with me. you don't get that anymore. There's great things about the internet, but what it's done is it placed responsibility much, much more on the individual to select the sources that they regard as credible, and to ask their own thoughtful questions instead of just taking it, as Walter Cronkite would say, and that's the way it is, because that isn't the way it is. If you're going to shape eventually your vote on impressions, and I think people last fall, when they voted, they saw the cabal against Trump. They saw the lawfare, the hoaxes, the lies, the deep state lies of partial truths or even total falsehoods, produced an element of sympathy, which is you don't usually associate with Trump, but I guess he'll take it if it gets him if it got him reelected. It's a messy time, and it's a time where the situations have evolved to place much more responsibility on individuals, which of course is why smart, intelligent, savvy, thinking individuals are watching this podcast this week.
That's right. Reading your columns or reading my stuff. Right. Absolutely. You know,
every week. And
all kidding aside, I mean, it's one of the reasons why we exist is because there's obviously a need for alternative, you know, sources of information. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up the thing about the war, right? And this has been going on ever since Trump hit Fordo, right? And the sort of the apotheosis of this was Saturday morning when I really didn't want to work, right? I had just felt like I had gone through the ringer this week. And a little inside baseball for all y'all that, you know, read us and watch us. I was just going to say, the hell with this. I'm going to write a Sunday reflection this morning and then just take the rest of the weekend off. And I've got columns up and all that kind of stuff. I'm just going to do it. And then I made the mistake of flipping over to the New York Times, which has been leading this thing, this charge about, you mentioned the low confidence portion of an intelligence assessment about the strike on Fordo, right? It wasn't even the whole assessment. It was a low confidence mention in a much larger report, which overall assessed that the strike on Fordo was very successful. But the media pulled this one little piece out because that was what got leaked to them and said, even American intelligence doesn't think that we've gotten Fordo done. And blah, 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 blah. Never mentioned, CNN never mentioned low confidence until people started challenging it. And so this has been going on. New York Times has been part of that as well. The New York Times on Saturday morning runs this piece. It wasn't really so much about Fordo, although it did have some stuff about Fordo. It was about Isfahan, right? And they have this piece up that says, actually, the strike on Isfahan did set the Iranian nuclear weapons program back several years because it destroyed where they were doing the metallization of uranium, which is the final stage before you can build a bomb. It's got to be put into a dense metal, which makes it a bomb. And they had a facility there that was doing that kind of work, and the IAEA knew it. They had already detected it. Iran refused to stop doing it. So that was why the Israelis were going after Isfahan, among other things. And it's also why they convinced Trump to not just hit Fordo, but to send Tomahawks to destroy the rest of the facilities at Natanz and Isfahan, specifically to get to destroy the metallization. So the New York Times admits on Saturday, oh yeah, they took that out. So yeah, they're not going to be able to build a nuclear weapon for several years because they're going to have to redo all that, right? They don't have that facility anyplace else. They can still enrich, although they have a few hundred centrifuges. It takes many thousands of centrifuges to do what it was that they were trying to do before. And then they said, but the metallization thing wouldn't have existed in the first place if Donald Trump hadn't gotten out of the JCPOA, the Iran deal. Because Iran wasn't going to build a nuclear weapon until Donald Trump canceled the Iran deal. Yeah. And they cited two sources for this, right?
Yeah.
Two sources. The first one was, and they actually did identify this. The first one was somebody who was involved in creating the JCPOA. It was one of the negotiators, right? It was the guy who was on the JCPOA team. The second guy, they didn't fully identify. They identified him as a physicist, with understanding of the Iranian nuclear program at some college. But what he also was he used to be a lobbyist for the American Physical Society, or American Physical Society or American Physical Association, I forget the precise name of this, who got canned in 2016 because he, as soon as Trump got elected, he declared that Trump was the most anti-science president we've ever elected. and they fired him as a lobbyist because, you know, that's really not a great way to ingratiate yourself to the new administration. This guy's been a TDS in that for some time. Those are the only two sources that said, well, it wouldn't have existed in the first place if it wasn't Donald Trump. So it starts off by saying, you didn't do anything. Well, maybe you did a few things, but you didn't do much. Well, okay, you did something, but it was your fault that you existed in the first place. Yeah. I was so pissed.
You had to write it.
I had to write it. I had to write it up. And it was like, at a certain point, I had to say, you know, I really need to wrap this post up because otherwise I'm going to be still adding to this tomorrow. I mean, it took me all of 5 minutes to check out the second guy. It took me all of 5 minutes to check out the second guy and discover that he had a deep personal animus towards Trump and was never going to admit that Trump actually did the right thing. And that was it. Those were two sources. That was it.
this is what we've all come to know since you were at Captain's Quarters, is that you're going to get at it one way or the other, and we'll get the whole works.
Only when people piss me off. And fortunately, that's about every damn day. I guess. Oh. I don't know. Anyway, so that maybe it gets to your point, right? And we're going to get to your column here in a minute. Is that journalism used to be about finding the story. I mean, actually finding the story, not promoting the narrative.
Right.
And that's what you talk about in your excellent column, by the way, Lessons from My Life in Journalism, Watching the Assaults on Donald Trump, is that all of this stuff, and I'm not saying that Donald Trump is perfect. There's stuff that he does that I don't like. You know, the problem is that there's no room to talk about that stuff because we're so busy disassembling all the crazy crap that the media is trying to push on this. It's one narrative after another. And I think that this attack on Fordo is really sort of, I think it's emblematic of the problems that the media has with narratives rather than stories.
Well, I think we talked about this a long, long time ago. The causes of the media decay are complex, and they existed long before Trump got into politics or even got into television. We, just briefly, I won't go into all the details, but in the 1970s, we had Watergate, which was a genuine scandal. The media jumped all over it. starting with the Washington Post, which was good in those days. And I remember I was on the New York Times, and they were scrambling almost every night to try to match the information, inside information that that the Washington Post had. Okay, then there was a movie and books, and it helped shape a generation of people who wanted to be journalists, and they wanted to have an impact. It wasn't that they wanted to tell a story or to be involved in the day's news, but they wanted to have an impact. And the impact, of course, became toppling a government or an individual or a scandal or whatever. And journalists got their constitutional protections because the founding fathers saw them as government watchdogs. Okay, good. But not just partisan watchdogs. And that's what over time it became. And then there was another factor that I'll touch on briefly, which was journalism had become a guy's game. And they were rightly forced to hire minorities and women and push them into positions of responsibility and so on. Well, in their eagerness to shuck off the shame of inequality, which existed for a long time, they pushed people who either were not qualified or might have been qualified if they were allowed to go through the apprentice programs. There's a reason for apprentice programs. And I'm not talking about a Middle Ages guilds where you spent half a lifetime as an apprentice. But I was an apprentice for a short time, a year and a half on the New York Times. But there were people who were trying to prove themselves to become reporters for 6 and 7 years, working on their own time to do stories that didn't have bylines to show the editors. And of course, the editors took advantage of it. It was cheap labor, and they could fill up the Sunday paper with stuff that they didn't have to plan for. And these people, some of them did become reporters, and some of them were just chewed up and spit out. But in the new age, they were pushed into doing things. New York Times, not just the New York Times, but they hired people and pushed them along. There was a guy they hired who didn't bother doing his expense accounts for thousands and thousands of dollars for years. And what did they do? They hired an accountant for him to create fictional expense reports to cover the tracks. The Washington Wow. Post. Yeah, the Washington Post had a young woman who got a Pulitzer Prize for writing this touching story about a young boy trying to survive, black boy in the ghetto or in the inner city. And she got a Pulitzer Prize, and it turns out she made the whole thing up. And the New York Times had another young guy that they pushed along as a rising star. And he had exclusive interviews. I forgot her name. Was it Jessica somebody? Remember the female soldier who got rescued by special ops in Iran?
I do recall that story. Yeah, I do recall that. Yeah.
And he had interviews with her and personal feature stories. He never left Brooklyn. Jason Blair, I think it was his name. He never left Brooklyn. He made the whole thing up. And for a long time, because they were invested in making him a star, paper ignored it. And then they investigated, and I think he did some 600 stories over time, and they found out over half of them were distorted or made up in some way or another.
And Stephen then Glass New Republic, right. You know, same thing, you know.
I remember sitting in and This is an observation. I was in a meeting of senior editors at the New York Times when the executive editor said he wanted to see more attitude in stories. Now, in my time, attitude was considered a cue hit, which was a special type of headline that indicated it was a news analysis. He wanted more attitude. Well, attitude used to be taken out of news stories. And if you want to write it, well, we'll talk about maybe a cue hit. And to my mind, this was the beginning of it's okay to slant things. And of course, that then became leave out important details that would hurt the theme of your story or hurt the politics that we want to support.
Right.
And it just got more and more corrupt. And as I mentioned in the column Sunday, it's now 69% of people have little or no trust in the media. Well, okay. So the alternative then is online media, not all of which is responsible or accurate and has the same sort of corruption problems that the mainstream media does. And we need a set in an operating democracy of commonly accepted facts that we can debate, honestly debate, you know, you're right, I'm right, you're wrong, whatever. And we don't have that now. We have narratives to argue over. And that's what I wanted to get into in the column, was how journalism has changed in the time, which is a long time, in the time since I aspired to get into it and to be able to tell stories and my name would be on top of it. And no doubt people would buy several copies of the paper just to have my stories. It's changed now. And I mean, I had, when I was a reporter on the Times, I had a colleague say, you know, boy, I never could have written that story. And I remember thinking, well, thanks. But geez, that's a terrible admission that you couldn't have written a story right down the middle. I did one about, remember the surrogate mother business? I did one where I interviewed surrogate mothers. I interviewed the couples that were hiring surrogate mothers. I interviewed the people who thought this was the end of the world. And I wrote a story, and it was page one, actually, it's the lead of the newspaper, one Sunday, in which, as you read it, you go, oh, isn't it wonderful that these women are helping couples without children to get a child? And then you thought, and then you got to the part where you said, oh, this is terrible. This shouldn't be allowed. And I wrote it honestly, and I think vividly about the strengths and the problems with each part of it. To me, that was just what you did. That's what made the story compelling, is that you were forced then to think about it. And I told it through people, I mean, real people. I just used their first names, but
right.
through the stories of real people who were going through it. And I listened sympathetically to all the sides. And I remember a colleague, and I could point her out in the crowd today, who said, boy, I couldn't have written that. This surrogate thing is just disgusting. And I remember thinking, geez. You know, it was just inconceivable. And that's where we are today. And so I wanted to write a column that was full of personal details and experiences that documented, to my mind, this decay, unfortunate decay for our society, not just for journalism.
And I think part of this is, I'm curious to get your read on this. I think part of this is the All the President's Men effect. This is a problem before that, right? But I think that this is sort of like throwing gasoline on the fire of narrative journalism, right? Which was that you had two reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, who were seen as taking down the presidency, getting a scalp, right? Becoming rock stars, celebrities. And both of those guys, especially Woodward, is a celebrity to this day, right? He's on all the TV shows. He gets to all the parties and all this kind of stuff. He's an interesting guy. I mean, I don't really begrudge him that. He did some interesting work. But there's two things about that. First off, these guys weren't really the whole story on how Watergate got in sports. In fact, other reporters and other newspapers actually did a significant amount of that work. They just got to write the book first. And they were, they played an important part of it. But the second thing was that once we found out who Deep Throat was, it became very clear that this was sort of a revenge sort of thing where one party was getting revenge on another. This is Mark Felt, right? The FBI, been passed over and he was bitter and all that kind of stuff, which is fine too. I mean, that's sometimes how these things get exposed, but it was a lot tawdrier, I think. More importantly, though, is it really skewed what journalism was supposed to be? Journalism was supposed, reporting was supposed to be about getting the facts in front of people and letting them make their own minds up. And then if you were really good at that and you'd been doing it for a while and you were able to accumulate some wisdom, then you became an analyst writing in, the Q-head sort of space or the opinion section. You get a column where you could say, this happened, we reported on this, this is what it means. This is how you should think about it. But people knew that that was what it was. But that plus the acceleration of, people coming straight out of J school into, expectations that they were going to be the next Woodward and Bernstein and trying to dig up the dirt on people instead of just learning the ropes through apprenticeship.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, just derailed the whole project, right? I mean, that's kind of what I think.
Yeah, absolutely. to make it clear, Watergate was a scandal, and it deserved exposure, and it deserved exposure. And they were good at it, and so were others. They got the credit. That's the way the celebrity-ness works. But you're right. The path then became, instead of honorably reporting and exposing things that might be wrong with government and letting the public decide, you created things that were wrong by distorting the narrative. And people who were in your cult, they now, because it's online, they clicked all over it, and you got celebrityness out of it, and you got on TV, and you were hailed. And the fact that you were only writing about 18% of the truth got lost and still does. And it still does. And it's sad. I don't want to be one of these old guys that said, oh, things were better in my day. There were a lot of things that sucked in my day.
You wrote about that a little bit in the column too. You wrote about the colleagues that you'd lost because they just simply got overwhelmed by the job that they were doing. I mean, it wasn't all peaches and cream, tough job.
That's right. Five colleagues from my reporting generation killed themselves. Four men and one woman. And I'm sure there were extenuating circumstances that I don't need to know, but they just got chewed up in the process. And it, personally, I mean, on that level, it's sad. On for democracy, it's terrible. And that's what I wanted to get at was I have found that stories are much more memorable and I believe powerful if you tell them through real people, through the lives, the travails, the successes of real people. And in this case, I guess I was the real people. I've done almost 3 dozen of these personal memories over there. This wasn't a standard Malcolm memory at Red State, but it had the tone of it. where I draw from my personal experiences and hopefully show how things have changed, which is, you know, if you're old enough, you hang around long enough, you see things that change that younger people don't know. You know, there was this president, I don't know if you remember, had that president named Jimmy Carter. So you see things, and if you know them well enough, you can write about it and how things have changed, and it kind of puts things in perspective. Hopefully it's also interesting. That's what I wanted to do with these memories. Some of them have to do with our childhood, but a lot of them have to do with my professional life as well.
Yep. Well, it's a great column, and people really should read it carefully, because it really does go into, there's a lot of wisdom in that column, just like there is in all of your columns, but this one's especially good. And oh, so I would, Lessons from My Life in Journalism, that's the column. This one is a VIP column. It's not part of his memories thing. This is, an argument by Andrew. It's really an indictment, I think, on an industry. And I think it's really well done. So that's what I wanted to cover today's podcast. You know, I was kind of promising that on Twitter, is that I was really impressed by this. And I think that this is something people need to read. So sign up for Red State VIP, or better yet, sign up for VIP Gold or Platinum, because then you get access to the hot air and the Red State stuff and all that kind of fun stuff. And, you know, we're sort of out of time here. He does have another good column up, by the way. I would tell people that, and I was trying to retweet this all weekend long, the man who ID'd bin Laden in hiding rots in a Pakistan prison. It's way past time to get him freed. And yes, I think that that's very true. I'm a little surprised that that Trump didn't get him out the first term.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, which I hope he does. I mean, if anybody can, Donald Trump can. The fact that he didn't, well, that nobody else did, which, you know, I was kind of expected, but all the other presidents haven't done it. But the fact that he didn't in the first term and hasn't so far picked up on it in this term, when in fact, I mean, he's gotten other people out who didn't do wonderful things for our country, leads me to suspect, all it is a suspicion, that there's something else going on here that I don't know what else it is, but it's so blatant. Our U.S. embassy official nailed this doctor, Shaquil Afridi, as the guy who fingered Osama bin Laden through his DNA. Now, you don't say your sources, but you sure as hell don't say you nail a guy, a Muslim, in a Muslim country that has embarrassed his homeland by pointing out that the seat that his government and intelligence service was doing for so long, hiding the world's worst murderer. I mean, it's just, so I don't know. Maybe there's something else to it. I hope Donald Trump gets him out. The guy, after all these years, what is it now, 14 years? 15. I'm not sure he would want to come to the U.S., but we do owe him the effort to get him out of prison, solitary confinement, sees his family once a month. They have to speak a certain language. He's got only the Quran. It's 5x7 cell. He can do push-ups and he can shave twice a week, but there has to be a witness. I mean, it's just brutal. And all this guy did, he may not have even known what he was doing, but somebody contacted him and wanted him to get DNA from that housing compound in Abbottabad. And his workers did it. And then we nailed them the way we nailed the Afghan allies and left them behind in Afghanistan and a lot of them in Vietnam. I don't know who would help us in the future if they know these stories. I hope Trump does something, but it seems like an ideal assignment for Rick Grenell.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And on that note, I guess we should get to the jokes of the day and lighten the mood up just a little bit.
I have one. I have one.
Okay.
I don't think I used this one before. There's a German driver who got pulled over by the police in France. And the police officers asked him for his name, and he said it. And he asked him for his age, and he said it. And then he asked the German driver, he said, occupation. And the German driver said, no, not this time. I just like that one. I have to say.
That one's good. All right. I got one for you here. The teacher sees a student wandering in the hall, right? And it's clearly during class time. So the teacher comes up and says, Jill, do you mind telling me which class you're cutting at the moment? And the teenager just sighs and rolls her eyes. She says, I really don't think it's that important, because I don't get anything out of it. And the teacher goes, oh, so it's your English class. I actually had a longer one that starts off well. One of the key punchlines is it's awfully dark in here, but it's kind of too long. I don't know if you know that joke, but
no,
I'll tell it anyway. Yeah, we'll squeeze it in here. So this woman's having an affair, right? And she hears her husband come home early, and she says, quick, go hide in the closet. So she hides in the closet. And this voice in the closet says, it's awfully dark in here. And he looks around. It's the woman's little girl who apparently had been hiding in the closet. And he goes, keep your voice down. And the little girl says, you know, I have a baseball here that my dad gave me. And he goes, shh. And she goes, would you like to buy my baseball? And the man says, okay, how much do you want for the baseball? She says, $100. He says, I'm going to pay you $100 for a baseball. She says, well, I'll just go out and tell my dad. He goes, okay, here's $100. Gives her $100. So a couple of weeks later, he's at the house again. And once again, the husband comes home early and the wife shoos him into the closet. He gets in the closet. And once again, the little voice goes, it's awfully dark in here. And he goes, ah. Oh. And she says, you know, my dad gave me this baseball glove. And he says, how much do you want for the baseball glove? She says, $200. He says, I'm not going to pay you $200. She goes, well, I'll just go out and tell my dad. And all right, here you go, $200. So the next day, her father's, it's Saturday. So her father says, why don't you grab your ball and glove and we'll go out and play catch. And she says, I can't. I sold my ball and my glove to my friend. And he says, well, how much did you get for it? And she says, $300. And he says, that's awful. Why would you, what? He says, that's like stealing money. It wasn't worth $300. He says, you need to go to confession. So he drags her down to the church and tells her to get into the confession booth. She walks in the confession booth and she says, it's awfully dark in here. And the priest goes, don't start that shit again.
Oh, I did not see that coming.
And somebody reminded me of that joke. Somebody reminded me of that joke the other day, and I thought, you know, I got to tell Andrew that joke. It's just it's...
okay. Hello.
All right. With that being said, and of course that was a little PG-13, but you know, with that being said, great talking with you again. We'll do this again next week. Talk about your latest columns and whatever else is in the news, especially about the Protection Racket Media and Narrative Laboratories. Andrew Malcolm, the prince of Twitter, at AH Malcolm on Twitter, of course, over at redstate.com. The man is just like a god at redstate.com. So there you go. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, everybody. And everybody have a happy July 4th. We'll see you next week.
Happy Independence Day, everyone.